Welcome to What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University's School of Medicine. This is your invitation to meet the faculty dedicated to understanding our most complex organ, committed to curing mental illness, and inspired to help create a healthier, thriving world. It is so good to have you back with us on What Makes Up Your Mind. I'm Jane McMillan. We are all searching for just a little more peace of mind, aren't we? Mental well-being. As the saying goes, maybe we should be looking in our own backyards or local parks or beaches and forests. And that's because science has proven that time in nature provides all kinds of physical and psychological benefits. Improved cognitive skills, better memory and retention, stress reduction, positive social interactions, and reduced anxiety and depression. In fact, just being near or having a view of green spaces is physically and psychologically helpful. Blue spaces, too, the open sky, water, rivers, oceans, ponds, all included in this. As American poet Wallace Stevens wrote, perhaps the truth depends on a walk around the lake. Well, it makes sense. The earth, it's our home, and we're one of and connected to all of its living elements. So how does it affect us as we see our natural home in peril? Because that means we are too. Our guest this time on What Makes Up Your Mind focuses her work at the intersection of what's happening to our planet with human-fueled climate change and our human mental health. Dr. Britt Ray is an instructor in Stanford's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and she's the director of The Circle, Community-Minded Interventions for Resilience, Climate Leadership, and Emotional Well-Being. The Circle is a special initiative focusing on researching the mental impacts of climate stress and grief and facilitating collaborative actions for people to take to help reduce their anxiety. This is an astoundingly massive, multi-layered, interconnected, time-critical challenge. So let's dive right in with Dr. Britt Ray. Dr. Ray, thank you very much for your time and your expertise. I can't wait to talk about this topic with you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jane. It's a pleasure.
You know, I'd like to start with kind of a big question, just to set the tone. On your website, there is a Lancet article that was from several medical editors. And the quote is, climate change is the biggest threat to public health facing humanity today. That's a huge statement. Help us understand that reality.
Mm-hmm.
Some ideas of in what ways this is the biggest public health threat and where the threat to mental health comes into it.
Absolutely. So our health is now literally at the mercy of fossil fuels. And that can sound overly dramatic or some kind of embellishment, but researchers have quantified multiple impacts across all aspects of physical and mental health from this activity that we are continuing to engage in, which is warming the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, predominantly oil, coal, and gas. But also, you know, the emissions that we're seeing, for instance, from animal agriculture and so on. And let's just take air pollution to start. The burning of fossil fuels, the combustion, creates air pollution, which gets into our lungs, which interacts with our brains. We know that of the more than 8 million people a year who die from outdoor air pollution, that over 5.1 million of those annual deaths can be traced specifically to the burning of fossil fuels. That research has been rigorously done and repeated by a variety of different groups. We see that with the increase in sea level rise and in carbon of concentration in the atmosphere and extreme temperatures and so on, there are all kinds of new health challenges, including that the spread of vector-borne diseases is getting worse and harder to mitigate against. Zika, malaria, dengue, these diseases via vectors are spreading in new patterns in greater swaths of the world that they hadn't previously, which is creating all kinds of tensions and challenges about how to protect populations from them. We're also learning that when the carbon concentration in the atmosphere goes up, it's harder to grow nutrient-rich crops, leading to micronutrient deficiencies across a variety of staple crops, wheat, maize, these kinds of things. And the drought that is coming with the warming is leading to soil desertification, which makes it harder to have staple bread baskets in order to produce crops at all in many regions of the world. We see, of course, that environmental degradation, which is coming with climate change, means that it's harder for human populations to make a living, to subsist off of the natural resources there. So they must move on to healthier pastures, which leads to climate migration and can stoke the risk of conflict as migrating groups come into contact in new areas and compete over dwindling resources. We also see that with the extreme heat, which is the deadliest of disasters, there's just more fatality, right? It's a big threat to our survival when we have increased heat waves and heat domes and so on, and that there's more frequent and ferocious storms, superstorms, hurricanes, cyclones, typhoons, wildfires, of course, which leave destruction in their wake in terms of life and property, and then all kinds of pollution and really difficult air pollution to have to contend with afterwards, where particle matter 2.5 mixes in the air, gets into our lungs, spreads throughout our body. There's all kinds of associations with respiratory diseases and cancers and so on. And the list kind of goes on and on and on. And the issue for mental health is that there's a well-understood, deeply described bidirectional relationship between physical and mental health. As our bodies get sicker, our minds and moods tend to suffer as well. So you can really think of this portrait of all these physical health impacts, of which I just mentioned a few of them, having a relationship with increasing the burden to mental health. But then beyond that, we're also dealing with collective traumas, as the wildfires, the floods, the superstorms hit communities, that can lead to clinical levels of anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder in their wake. Often when there have been these acutely traumatic events, there's a difficulty with coping in strange new environments. When people have a disruption to their access to necessities such as food and work and shelter and school, and they're cooped up together in makeshift houses and so on, stress levels can really get high. You see an increase in maladaptive coping with drugs and alcohol, increased domestic abuse, child abuse, and so on. And sometimes there's a complete loss of community cohesion or identity or suicidal thinking and behavior. And then we know that extreme heat is linked with violence and aggression and self-harm. There are studies to show that hospital admissions for self-harming behaviors go up on extreme heat days in many cities around the world, for instance. And there's research to show that the psychological impacts of disaster outweigh the physical impacts about 40 to 1. So usually when we're hearing about these climate disasters in the news, if the media is good enough to attribute them to climate change, we'll see, you know, the reports on the wildfires where the structures have been burnt down, or we'll see the pictures of windswept shorelines where a hurricane came through and then tossed all the buildings in the air and they came back down looking like a splintered mess on the shore. So we tend to focus on the physicality of the destruction and the loss, but don't have the measured conversation around all the invisible impacts of how this is changing our psychology, our stress levels, interacting with the strength of our community ties, our social connections, which really undergird resilience, and so on. And then people have to enter this really stressful period of figuring out how to rebuild, right? How to navigate difficult insurance markets and talk with the government and recoup what they can and afford to get back on their feet and so on in a time of mass disorientation, which can lead to prolonged effects of chronic stress. So that's quite a lot. It's quite a hefty amount of impacts that we're seeing that are directly and indirectly related to climate change. And then another thing worth mentioning is this whole area that we now call climate distress. And you've perhaps heard of climate anxiety, climate grief. There are these different emotional components that can be quite challenging to deal with when confronting the climate crisis, when merely thinking about it, when understanding the severity of climate science and what it's telling us about the future that we are moving towards, given the lack of responsible and adequate action from power holders, governments, multinational companies, where their actions could really shift the needle, but we see not enough action being taken. This can create a profound form of different existential emotions. So we see that climate anxiety is a type of death anxiety, actually, that people fear death and destruction for themselves or their loved ones from climate events, or imagine scenarios in the future where the climate crisis becomes more severe. And there's grief for environmental losses that are underway, perhaps a particular natural environment that you grew up in being irreversibly changed by climate impacts and no longer feeling at home there, or aspects of one's culture and identity that kind of wither away along with the stability of an ecosystem, which produces a questioning of who one is even, and how one's identity has to change when an environment itself or a place-based relationship has shifted beneath your feet. So there's tons of data to show that climate anxiety is real. It's particularly felt by young people, though not exclusively. And essentially anyone who has both eyes open is able to appreciate the extent to which their own health is tied up with the health of the environment. They understand the environment is not doing well along a variety of measures of planetary health. Well, then there's going to be a susceptibility to feeling some climate-related distress if one has a high degree of environmental identity, feeling a connection to the more than human world.
And so just speaking along psychological terms for a moment, is it the huge existential nature of this that allows the portion of humanity that is not already physically, obviously affected to either deny it, ignore it, and perhaps still be stressed by it? And then how do we who are not impacted immediately by a fire, by a flood, how do we recognize stress we are dealing with, that is climate stress? Maybe that's the disconnect.
There's so much to what you're asking, and it's really complex. There are a variety of theories. As you gestured at in the beginning of that question, this is overwhelming. The emotions that can follow consciously grappling with the severity of the climate and wider ecological crisis can be paralyzing for some people. They can lead to a kind of shutdown because they simply can't tolerate the intensity of the overwhelming feelings that follow their conscious awareness. And so it can be easier to block it out, whether that is unconscious or conscious. Psychoanalysts who study the climate crisis talk a lot about the different forms of denial that exist, that there is hardcore denial, the, you know, types that we see backed up with corporate malfeasance and just bad faith ideological argumentation, saying that it's a hoax. Often those purporting those arguments are making money off of the fossil fuel industry in some way, shape, or form. But then there's a softer form of denial that many of us unwittingly participate in. And that's called disavowal, where we have one eye open to the truth. We don't deny that this is happening. We believe that all-out action is needed. We will go out and cheer on the need to vote for climate leaders and so on. But then simultaneously, to protect ourselves, we close the other eye to the full scope of what we're facing. We might read a scientific paper that warns that we are quickly about to surpass dangerous climate tipping points that will lead to really devastating outcomes. And then, you know, simultaneously, we don't think that anything so terrible can truly come to pass. And we kind of turn away from that alarming and really distressing idea. And then we go back to ordering stuff on Amazon, buying the next flight, whatever it may be, you know, not making the uncomfortable comment at the board meeting about business practices. And we remain kind of deadlocked in this status quo place of not firmly standing up for all-out action, which is needed at this time across all aspects of society. You know, that softer denial is understandable because we have a bunch of unconscious psychological defenses we've evolved to protect us from anxiety and pain, because we need to go about our day with a certain brightness of mind, to enjoy ourselves, to be functioning. But it's important to be conscious, or to try and be conscious of when that's happening, so that you can still be of use and still take appropriate, responsible action. There are some people who I'm sure are simply not feeling this and not leaning into the climate crisis, not because they're engaged in some kind of sophisticated denial, but they're just, they don't have a strong feeling of connection to the more than human world, to nature. It's not something that's really salient for them. And they would listen to everything that I just said and say that it's garbage and it doesn't apply to them. It's hard to understand why people wouldn't care about the very planetary, ecological substances all around us that enable our life to exist. But you know, at the same time, we're in a polycrisis. It's not just climate. We have many intertwining crises that are swirling together in a vortex where they're kind of deepening the threat together across multiple areas, economic threats and war and the climate crisis and every now and then a pandemic. And for some people, different parts of the polycrisis are just more immediate threats to them. And that's what they focus on. And that's how they feel they need to, you know, divert their attention day to day in order to get by and be okay and provide for their family. And I've had many conversations with people who say it's gun violence, or it's, you know, systemic racism, for instance, or it's economic insecurity that they're much more riled up about. And the climate crisis is, you know, 10th on the list. It's not that they don't care. They just see it as a less salient feature of what directly threatens their day-to-day existence. There's lots of nuance to be brought up here, but because it is this threat multiplier that is making things harder across all aspects of society, that also means that we can reach out and touch it from wherever we are in society, and we can do something to be part of pro-environmental and pro-social movements.
To talk about this, our psychological mindset, how we cope with these things and why we can focus on some and choose not to on others. And I think it's important to talk about that. Why do some things resonate with us and why not? And you're right, it's triage, physical and psychological triage. But there's a group of people that you mentioned at the very beginning that seem to be much more in tune with this, aware of it, worried about it, impacted by it in terms of mental health and looking at their future, and those are young people.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you've done a study, and it's one of the first to really look at the attitudes of young people and how they are perceiving this threat and what it means for their individual lives. Tell us about your study.
Sure. So there's a few studies that have kind of worked in tandem together to help paint this picture. If we go back to 2021, my colleagues and I surveyed 10,000 16 to 25 year olds across 10 countries, India, Nigeria, the Philippines, Brazil, US, France, Portugal, and others, really diverse swath of countries. And we're trying to understand at a, you know, just a cross-sectional snapshot point of view, how their climate thoughts and feelings are affecting their day-to-day experience. And we were pretty alarmed to see how strong the signal of climate distress was when we got the results, because 45% of these young people globally reported that their thoughts and feelings about the climate crisis were interfering with daily life tasks like eating and sleeping and concentrating. 75% of young people globally said that the future is frightening to them because of climate change. 56% said they feel humanity is doomed as a result of this crisis. 39% said that they feel hesitant to have their own children one day because of the threats to young people's well-being in the next generation. And so this really got us intrigued about how are climate thoughts and feelings shaping young people's future plans, you know, around other dimensions, not just this reproductive anxiety piece, but do they feel like they have to move or want to work in a different kind of sector or job, or what kind of educational training do they want to get? Do they feel they have to make a big, bold, radical change in their life to be prepared for the future they're getting? And we did a couple more studies that both came out in the last year. And so in one, we were specifically honing in on the U.S. We wanted to understand at a national level, using a large sample, what's going on in this age range of 16 to 24-year-olds. And so in the first study, we surveyed around 3,000 American youth in this emerging adult category. And we wanted to understand, what's going on with the relationship between mental health and their climate emotions, but also their sense of agency, this impact on future thoughts and feelings. And does this change if they're someone who's identified as being impacted by a climate disaster or not? And we found that the American youth felt concerned, disappointed, frustrated, sad, anxious, and angry as the predominant emotional responses to the crisis. And that majority report that their climate awareness may influence their plans for education, and for travel, and for family planning, and getting themselves prepared for the future in ways that school is not currently setting them up. And the key takeaway was that the psychological impacts of climate change in American youth can have both impairing and strengthening effects. So we did see that if there was more climate distress, there was also often a stronger signal of climate agency, which is not surprising in the sense that many other studies have shown that there can be adaptive qualities to feeling very concerned or anxious about the climate crisis, that the distress seems to get you to sit up straight, reassess how you're living, figure out ways that you can try and directly address the thing that is stressing you, which would mean taking climate action, strategizing with others, joining climate groups, figuring out how to connect with a community of caring others who share your values so that you're not isolated in these concerns and you can strategize together about ways you can try and move the needle or organize. And all of that expresses a kind of virtuous element of agency that can increase your belief in yourself and tap into efficacy and hopefully widen the aperture of the sense that the actions that you take do matter and so you should take more of them. And we did find that there is that kind of strengthening effect coming out in the data, but also, you know, self-reported direct experience of being through a wildfire or a hurricane, for instance, or a flood was across the board associated with increased, so stronger eco-anxiety, climate distress, and impact of climate thoughts and feelings on their future plans, but also these fortifying responses such as agency and figuring out ways to make meaning from the crisis in order to psychologically adapt.
That would, I'm assuming, take some knowledge on the part of adults in their lives, though, to help empower that sense of agency. Youth, at least in the teens until they're legal adults, are not necessarily in a position to take action and make decisions about their future. And so did you find any nuances there in terms of their ability to find strength or purpose or have a brighter view of the future based on their own agency, on whether or not they're surrounded by adults or policymakers who are not denying this and who are recognizing the need for action?
Yeah, those are really interesting questions. We didn't set up our survey in a way that was asking about their relational context to supportive parents or policymakers, for instance, in their proximity who could help to fortify that. But in a separate study, again, of American youth, this time we looked at a much greater sample. It was 16 to 25-year-olds. And it was over 16,000 that we surveyed this time, so much bigger sample. And we were asking about many more things. And we were also looking across all 50 states. So we wanted to understand, does this look really different in Republican households versus, you know, Democratic versus independent in terms of how the youth tell us that they identify? And it was really interesting because there wasn't a single state sample where the endorsement of climate distress came in under 75%. And we did see that 42.8, so about 43% of youth in America say that climate change is having an impact on their self-reported mental health. And 85% of American youth from this sample say that they're at least moderately worried about the climate crisis, and 58% said that they're very or extremely worried about the climate crisis. And this was seen across all political affiliations. And what was different about the study is that we did ask them about some of these relational components, like, do you ever try to talk about your concerns to elders in your life, you know, to parents and grandparents and teachers and so on? And we got an overwhelming response that yes, many have tried to bring this up, but they feel belittled or dismissed in their concerns. And they showed a very strong wish for adults to understand their feelings. But there's a massive gap between them attempting to create those relational contexts where they can talk about it, and then how understood they actually feel, how well seen in their concerns they felt by the elders around them. So there's this massive disconnect essentially around the distress that young people are feeling and how safe and well supported they feel by teachers and parents in their lives.
This is work that you are focused on, that community collaboration, bringing youth into this process and giving them agency in a circle. One of the focuses is something called Why Care, working with youth from other countries, youth that are already involved in working on this as a supportive group, and helping them identify the fact that they're suffering from climate distress and anxiety and some of the processes they can put in place to address it.
Yeah, so YCARE stands for Youth Co-Designing Adaptations for Resilience and Empowerment, and it's a research project that we have going on internationally between Australia, Canada, and the U.S., where we're partnered with networks of what are called integrated youth services. Integrated youth services are this really amazing, innovative sector of care that are completely youth-facing, but they provide mixed services that are social services and mental health services. And often they're provided in these community healthcare settings. And there are these youth wellness hubs that are even designed by youth themselves sometimes. And they're a safe place for young people to hang out after school with their friends and get away from neighborhood street violence and access, you know, support for mental health concerns or things around addiction and housing and so on. And they've just been very effective. This model was created in Australia by a group called Headspace because they were so successful at increasing youth well-being through this type of care. Many other countries started following suit. And at Stanford, we have a project from Dr. Steve Adelsheim's group at the Center for Youth Mental Health and Wellbeing, which is called ALCOVE. And ALCOVE is out there in the community. They're across the state of California. It's a network of integrated youth services. They are opening up new hubs. They've already got a variety of them operational. And they are using this model, this wonderful IYS model, integrated youth services, to bring that to America. There's another group in British Columbia called Foundry, and they've got 37 hubs across the province. So we're partnered with both ALCOVE and Foundry on this project, and Headspace, the progenitor of this model in Australia, and another Australian network called Origin. So altogether, working with these partners, they're serving hundreds of thousands of youth a year through their online and clinical services. And what their service providers have told us is that young people are coming into their centers. They're talking about the climate crisis affecting their mental health, reporting climate anxiety and all the things that we've been chatting about. But the service providers don't know what to do in those moments because they haven't been trained in how to meet that moment. And when you look in the literature, there's nothing that's rigorously tested and evidence-based with objective data around it in terms of what are the best interventions to deploy at this time. So through this research project, we're partnering with these wonderful integrated youth services around the world. We are now working with 18 young co-designers who have been hired, recruited through the networks of these centers. And they are helping meet us halfway, where we bring what the research and literature is showing about what is most likely to be effective for the non-pathological nature of climate distress. And there's a lot of good theory and evidence to show why group work and peer support are promising models for helping youth with climate anxiety. And then the young people are bringing their lived experience and their passion and their interest and their taste to weigh in on co-designing a youth-led peer support program for climate anxiety that is going to be acceptable to them and feasible for our IYS partners to implement. So we are getting closer to understanding what the youth-led peer support program will look like. We're halfway through a really intensive co-design process. Then we'll be packaging that intervention into something that can be piloted and piloting the peer support program across Australia, Canada, and the U.S., and hopefully creating some of the first longitudinal data sets around, you know, what is showing a preliminary signal of efficacy for relieving the mental health burden of climate anxiety, understood as functional impairment, and increasing a sense of community for these youth and belonging and agency, and all kinds of other good things that are protective for mental health and being able to deal with the problem of climate change rather than turn away from it out of self-protection. So we're really excited about that. It's it really is one of the first that has been developed with research in mind. There are other programs that people are using, which are great. You know, there's a lot of user satisfaction surveys and whatnot to show that people think that it's helping. But this is all in the gray literature, and they're pretty informal peer supports and community-based organizations that have launched these out there. So we're just trying to bring some of the rigor from an evidence-based perspective that will help us speak with policymakers and program managers and, you know, healthcare systems and schools and places where youth are every day, so that we can help to really bring support that has evidence behind it in all these different settings where we know that climate anxiety is showing up. Starting with the youth-facing mental health care systems through the IYS model, but we're also very interested in the educational sector, because so many teachers talk about climate anxiety being in their classroom, and the conversation is really familiar. The teachers, just like the service providers from the youth mental health care systems, they say they don't know what to do in those moments because they haven't been trained on how to address it in the classroom and so on. And so, you know, we just have a lot of deep listening to do and learning to understand what superintendents and principals and teachers and students and so on are experiencing and what their needs are in this space too.
Encircle offers educational workshops for the adults in these young people's lives to help with that. Would the basis of Why Care, would this be replicable for smaller groups? You know, local organizations, maybe clubs, even within a classroom?
Absolutely, yes. We are not designing it for that at the initial pilot phase, but what we're talking about is not clinical in nature. It's community-minded. It is something that, you know, some lived experience and care are the main ingredients, and it can be democratized. And there's so much exciting work happening in terms of lay-led approaches to psychosocial support that this really belongs to, the world of task shifting and task sharing and paraprofessionals. And there's all kinds of ways in which we can imagine that being able to channel in and connect with community groups. But first, we just have to focus on the original pilot before we get to adapting and testing it in different kinds of environments. But I have hope that it will be useful there.
Sure. We've talked about the survey and the results and the explicit anxiety that has come forward. But that's from those questions that were specifically about climate anxiety. And I'm wondering if you could help the rest of us see how maybe this is manifesting and we might not recognize it as climate anxiety, behavior, illness. How might actions tell us that somebody is suffering from this as well, this type of anxiety, that we might not identify it? Because again, if we're triaging, we talked about all the other things going on in life, it might not be the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting cases that I could share of how this has appeared in different people's lives. So one woman who recently lost her home in the LA wildfires, and it was her childhood home. She and her husband are living in a fire-prone area not too far away, but her childhood home is gone. She's now experiencing such overwhelming anxiety that she is no longer able to sleep many nights. And on red flag days, she is a complete nervous wreck and doesn't sleep at all. She's preoccupied. She can't concentrate. She's very fixated on the fire weather. And it's getting into a very bad place for her relationship with her husband because he does not feel her concerns to the same degree, to the point where she cannot tolerate living in their home together. And she's thinking of leaving her husband in order to get away from their home. We often see the distress becoming this overwhelming, effective thing that starts to impact people's relationships. We mentioned it in some of the findings from the studies with youth, but a big one is this area of eco-reproductive concerns, where there's couples in disagreement. One says that they don't feel it's okay to bring a child into a, you know, quickly worsening climate crisis, and the other thinks that that is simply giving up or lacking resilience. We see people get really preoccupied with their carbon footprint, panic attacks in the grocery aisle if they're looking around and seeing that everything is in its own single-use plastic packaging and just contemplating that this is simply one aisle in one grocery store, and think of the thousands of grocery stores across the country where this is the case, looking out by scales of magnitude and just getting completely overwhelmed. There's reports of children being unable to get in the car with their parents when they're, you know, polluting together or trying to go on a family holiday together, and they don't want to get on a flight with their parents who think that they're just crazy or out to lunch with their concerns. So there can be this kind of really heavy preoccupation with personal carbon footprints. So those are some examples. I hear a lot about people having sleep problems, things affecting concentration, just complete preoccupation, often this kind of voracious information seeking where, you know, something alarming has happened. Maybe they've lived through a heat dome or there's been a disaster, climate disaster nearby, or they read another, you know, recently published UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which helps them see with a new freshness about how dangerous this is within their lifetimes and how quickly things are changing and how ineffective the action is. And then they'll just kind of spring into obsessively reading everything that they can find about the climate crisis and overwhelming themselves with a deluge of scary information without being conscious of their digital diet and broadening out enough to be able to bring in simultaneous truths of supportive things that are also part of the world that are beautiful and uplifting. And that can really collapse a person in a space of, you know, dark, depressive thoughts and feelings that might narratively foreclose their sense of what's possible in the future and make them feel hopeless. And there's even clinical cases of eating disorders from people with climate anxiety. Again, where there's such a focus on, you know, sustainable consumption and carbon footprints that they stop consuming food that carries a carbon footprint and become malnourished. But these are some extreme cases that I've just talked about, and there are cases of suicidal thinking too from climate anxiety. And, you know, there is an increased risk that those with pre-existing mental health challenges, maybe they have an anxiety disorder of some sort, they are more susceptible to experiencing impairing levels of climate anxiety. But you don't need to have pre-existing mental health challenges to be significantly affected by climate anxiety, and there are multiple studies to show this now. A lot of the distress is not pathological in nature. It is uncomfortable, it's painful, but it isn't necessarily functionally impairing. But it does create this sense of just deep dread and there being a terrible wrongness in the world. And to see day to day your reality, the world you're moving through with those climate goggles on, and you can't unsee it once you've seen it, it's deeply distressing to bear witness to the injustices, to these preventable harms that we don't need to be walking into if only we were listening to the scientists and not wasting decades when we could have been acting more effectively on this. And it's a deep, deep kind of moral injury, a sense of being caught up in a system that is actively violating what is right and what is wrong as you understand those things to be according to your values. And that's difficult. That's psychologically damaging. And there's also this concept of institutional betrayal, where, you know, we understand that the power holders, governments, companies, fossil fuel lobbyists, and so on, those in charge are not upholding their end of the deal to protect those that are dependent on them and the vulnerable, and especially young people, children, this intergenerational theft and trauma that's going on. That is studied. There's research behind this concept of institutional betrayal, where institutions and power holders are letting their end of the deal go and they're abandoning the building. That leaves those who are dependent upon them feeling gaslit, betrayed, abused, and it's hard to then have trust in societal sectors or leaders or institutions themselves, which is also psychologically damaging. So a lot of the non-pathological distress is just kind of working through these different levels of awareness and feeling, but it can tip over into things that become functionally impairing, that block your ability to just move through your day to day. But it's really diverse in terms of how it presents.
You just validated, in such a sad but beautiful way, validated that feeling of moral injury. And I am guessing that a lot of people feel it, maybe haven't put into their own words that that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very enlightening moment, listening to you describe that.
Yeah.
And there is strength in numbers.
Yeah.
There are places and people with whom we can join to do something. And I love what Circle is doing with connecting climate minds, bringing all the international researchers and the best minds together, and also the climate conversations. This, to me, is such a beautiful intervention and psychological support. And this is a global thing. Nigeria, Britain, the U.S. Tell us more about that, because that to me is the next step and that people can find some real sustenance from.
Thank you. Well, the Climate Conversations pilot was an attempt at creating spaces for brave and connective, honest conversations around the mental health and emotional repercussions of the climate crisis between elders and young people to really try and foster some intergenerational solidarity, to help young people feel seen and supported by their elders. And it came out of a co-creative process between a young climate activist in Lagos, Nigeria, and climate psychotherapist practicing in London, UK, and myself. And we ended up working across these three really disparate environments, setting up groups with youth and elders. I was actually working with community health workers in New Orleans, Louisiana, from the Black community, who were dealing with so much trauma around hurricanes, still identifying as being post-traumatically stressed from Katrina back in 2005, and yet are dealing with so many impacts from climate-related disasters year on year. And we listened to what the community members wanted, and we co-designed a facilitation guide to host these group meetings between elders and youth within each community. And it was incredible to see how it took off and how there was this strengthening of relational solidarity and solidarity sense making and giving people language to describe their experiences that many of them said they didn't have before, and revealing a hunger and transferring knowledge and insights between elders and youth on the climate crisis to find ways of strategizing about ways to deal with these mental health impacts that they could see in their community. And I kid you not, it was incredible to watch that without even planting these kinds of ideas in the facilitation guide, they would just naturally start saying, like, who's our local representative? How can we organize? Like, what can we do? Bringing it to action after a certain amount of time had been spent exploring and sharing and building trust and just talking about their experiences and what it feels like whenever there's a new evacuation order, or, you know, the panic around making sure that everything's in their go bag, or the kind of distress they feel about the future in a more abstract way. In Lagos, the group there, the intergenerational connections that were made were so gorgeous. They ended up spontaneously singing together at the end of each meeting.
Gosh.
They were all Black Africans. But in the London group, it was totally different, which was very interesting. It was with a more upper middle class, predominantly white group. And there was actually a breakdown in the intergenerational solidarity where some of the elders could not tolerate the distress of the youth. The youth were talking about their climate anxiety and being very frank about it. And there was some denial that came up amongst the elders there. The facilitator, who was overwhelmed trying to manage this group and watching it kind of break down the deeper into the process they got, just could see there was guilt that the elders felt they needed to defend themselves against. And some of them did in this way that was a little bit belittling of the experience of the youth themselves. And it might be something to do with privilege and how one's living and a certain lifestyle that's been afforded by high carbon emissions and all of that. So it was a really interesting project. It's not currently in motion, but it would be nice to find some funding so we can continue it.
What is next in your research?
Well, YCARE is a multi-year mega project, so it really is taking a lot of our time as we move beyond piloting, and we'll have to do something more rigorous like a randomized control trial. And we're also looking at adapting it and testing it in different environments, including schools and community groups, like you mentioned. So that's on deck for the next foreseeable future.
We look forward to the research that comes next, and we look forward to the expansion of YCARE, and hope you'll join us again. Dr. Britt Ray, thank you so much for your work and for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane, today. And if any of this resonated with anyone out there and they'd like to find out more about the work, please do sign up for my newsletter, which is unthinkable.substack.com.
Yes, and you'll find a link to Dr. Ray's newsletter, Unthinkable, in our program notes, as well as links to The Circle and Dr. Ray's books. Her latest is Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Anxiety. And it offers more on that generational perspective she's been talking about with us here, and on how to stay sane amid the climate crisis. We hope this program has given you valuable insight, and not only into the critical challenge we're facing, but also how we can find agency and care for our mental well-being, even in the midst of a global crisis. Because this is why we're here. So please do join us again next time on What Makes Up Your Mind. I'm Jane McMillan. You've been listening to What Makes Up Your Mind. Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health, from the experts in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. For more information on this program and all of our transformational work, visit us at med.stanford.edu/psychiatry. What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health is a production of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine, a copyright of the Board of Trustees of Stanford University.